Good afternoon. I'm Cal Winslow, your host today. I'm very happy to be back with KZYX this summer with a new series of programs. I'm calling these an antinomian hour. I'm using the word antinomian, a very old concept, to describe people who work against the grain, people who think for themselves, and people who believe that doing the right thing is the important thing. Our program consists of a series of in-depth interviews broadcast here on KZYX every Thursday this summer at 1 p.m. Our guest today is Sylvia Federici. Federici is a teacher, a writer, and an activist. She's long been a voice for feminism, both in this country and internationally. She grew up in Italy and came to the United States to study for a Ph.D. in philosophy at the University of Buffalo. She's taught at the University of Port Harcourt in Nigeria, and she was a professor of political philosophy and international studies at New College of Hofstra University. She was a co-founder of the International Feminist Collective, an organizer of the Wages for Housework campaign, and she's associated with the Midnight Notes Collective. She's also a founder of the Committee for Academic Freedom in Africa, and the Radical Philosophy Association Anti-Death Penalty Project. Federici's best known work, perhaps, is Caliban and the Witch, Women, the Body, and Primitive Accumulation. She's also the author of a new collection of writings, Revolution at Point Zero, Housework, Reproduction, and Feminist Struggle, which was published in 2012 by PM Press here in Oakland. In addition, she's edited Enduring Western Civilization, The Construction of the Concept of Western Civilization and Its Others, and has written many shorter pieces, including Feminism and the Politics of the Commons, on capitalism, colonialism, women and food politics, and witch hunting, globalization, and feminist solidarity in Africa today. Sylvia, hello. Can I call you
hello.
Sylvia?
Yes.
That's all right. Well, I'm very happy to be able to talk to you today. I'm wondering if I could begin with a kind of a large question. And you've been an activist in the feminist movement for quite some time. I wondered if you might reflect for a moment on what you see as the larger history, I guess, of the feminist movement, a sort of results and prospects, say, maybe from the 70s.
Well, yes, you're right. It's a very large question, and one that is very important to me, to my work, because I believe the feminist movement has played a revolutionary role in the development of politics and social relations in our country and across the world, particularly in the first period of its development, because it was able to, in fact, expose a whole area of exploitation and a area of discrimination that had been very much marginalized, if not made invisible, even in radical movements. And clearly, it has forced a transformation of social relations that has affected every area of life, you know, from the, you know, everyday relationship between men and women to part of the organizational work, and also the perspective of practically all the disciplines. At the same time, I would say that the women's movement has not been able to translate its insights and to translate its revolutionary impulse into a strategy that would be able in the long term to transform society. I see and I hope that this will be a project that new feminists will engage in. But certainly in the 70s, The first attempt to transform society, in a sense, was not realized. And one of the problems, I believe, is because the women's movement concentrated many of its efforts in transforming a struggle for equality, first of all, with men, a struggle for equal rights, and also concentrated all his effort into gaining access to those areas of work, and particularly wage labor, that had been traditional male domain, on the assumption that this would be the best road to emancipation. And in that process, it abandoned the struggle over the terrain of reproduction, the reproduction of day-to-day life, the reproduction of human beings, that had been one of the discoveries of the movement. In other words, in reflecting upon the causes, on the roots of discrimination on a sexual basis, on a gender basis, the feminist movement had really discovered the whole terrain of reproduction as a terrain not of natural relations, as we are often led to believe, but an area of relation that had been very much captured, subordinated to the capitalist organization of work, that had been transformed into instrument for the production of the workforce, and as such, completely distorted. And central to that insight had been the fact that the women's movement discovered the devaluation of reproductive work, the fact that historically, the devaluation of the social position of women has been tightly connected to the devaluation of domestic work, reproductive work, and that this devaluation has been very important in the process of capitalist accumulation, because it has kept, maintained the cost of labor power very, very low. So the terrain of reproduction has been very central, very important for the women's movement, but slowly by the mid-70s, it was abandoned, whereas most of the energies of feminist organization was concentrated, as I said, for the struggle for the Equal Rights Amendment, also the struggle for comparable wage for comparable work, which, as important as they've been, have become almost the exclusive terrain of feminist organizing, to the point that, for example, in the United States, we do not even have maternity leave. The terrain of reproduction was practically abandoned. The United States is one of the few countries in the world, for example, where women do not even have, maternity leave. Similarly, the struggle that women on welfare were making, to expand the resources, that they would be able to have access to, and also to, erase, the kind of blame that was associated to welfare. The struggle was never, supported, adequately supported, to the point that, in fact, in 1993, Bill Clinton could practically erase welfare, which, in my view and in the view of many other feminists, was in fact an important recognition that raising a child is work. That raising a child is not only a personal issue, but is in fact is a work, and that all society and certainly all employers benefit from it. And therefore, in a sense, the society, the state has a duty to make resources available to women who do that work. Now, I hope that the lesson that we have learned over the years, which is that gaining access to wage labor is not necessarily the road to revolution or the road to a qualitatively change in social relations. I hope that the lesson has been learned and will inspire younger women to a different type of politics, to a type of politics that does not separate the so-called workplace, the wage workplace, from the rest of our life. And in a sense, begins to recenter, the political activism of the feminists on also the question of reproduction, which I think is very central. It's, in a sense, the pillar of not only our struggle, but the pillar of the capitalist organization of work. And it's where we need to begin if we want to really transform the social relation in our society.
Okay, very interesting. There's a lot there. Let me ask you about two things. I wondered if you could, for my sake and our listeners' sake, just be a little bit more specific about the areas that you referred to as unpaid labor. You've mentioned raising children, but that's, I think, just one. So I wondered if you might just give us a bit more detail on your thinking on that situation, and then perhaps following up on that question I have. Now, I think since the 70s, there has been a transformation of the workforce, at least in the United States, with the massive entry of women into paid labor, for what that's worth. So how would that affect the analysis that you've been giving us?
Yes, and the question of unpaid labor, yes, well, throughout the history, certainly the history of capitalist society, women have been the unpaid labor of the world. And what I mean by that is that whatever work they may have done, you know, in the factories, in offices, the primary work that has been expected of women has been what is called domestic work. And domestic work has been considered non-work, it's been non-remunerated, and in fact, it's often been made completely invisible, certainly as a form of exploitation. I think, as I mentioned before, it was an important step taken by many feminists and the feminist movement to see that this work that has been traditionally so marginalized, and in many cases even by, you know, radical thinkers, considered a legacy of a pre-capitalist world. In other words, considered a work outside of capitalist relations. It has been a very important contribution of the women's movement to see that, in fact, this work is probably the pillar of the whole organization of work, because it does not produce clean clothes, food, you know, and basically personal services. But what it does, it produces the workforce itself. It produces on a day-to-day basis and on a generational basis the worker. And in a way, there's nothing more important. There's no more important production because without the workforce, there's no other form of activity that is possible.
Mm-hmm. So, and internationally, is the situation, your analysis, the same internationally as well as, say, in this country?
Well, actually, it's a very important question that you're asking, because what we have noticed is that every time in a society there has been a change, there's been a shift from types of production centered on subsistence, centered on, you know, use values, to a type of production based on the market, you know, organized on a more capitalistic basis, women have been the great losers, because women have been those who have been pushed back. They've been basically transformed into unpaid housewives, into unpaid producers of services and workers. And so every time there's been, In a way, you know, this is very contrary to the popular ideology that capitalism has improved the condition of women and has expanded the area of equality between women and men. In reality, you know, the opposite has been true. Whereas in societies that were more centered on subsistence, women usually had access to the produce of their work, where, for example, production was organized communally, and women also had access to the means of their reproduction. They had access to land, they had access to for example, whatever products you could find in the woods, in the forest, as soon as the society becomes organized on a monetary basis, you know, we find that actually women are excluded from it, and they become unpaid labor. And with that, they become dependent on men. And with that dependence, of course, you know, we have, you know, a tremendous hierarchy is created. And, you know, many forms of violence, male violence towards women, can be explained on that basis. Now, clearly, since at least the late, the mid-80s and more through the 90s, in the United States, in Europe and other countries, not universally though, but certainly in Europe and the United States, very much as a consequence of the feminist movement and the kind of restructuring that have taken place in the global economy, we have seen the large number of women, even women with children, have entered the wage workforce. This, however, has not eliminated the unpaid labor they have done in the home. Part of it has been commercialized, you know, part of it has been organized outside the home. In some cases, there has been also restructuring of reproductive work. For example, the phenomenon that is often referred to as the globalization of care. The globalization of care is the fact that some of the work, of the domestic work, usually performed by women in Europe and the U.S. has been actually done by immigrant women. Who have migrated, you know, have migrated to our countries, you know, because the global restructuring of the economy has devastated the economies of the countries they come from. And therefore, in order to eke out a living, they have had to migrate and take up some of the reproductive work, you know, that, you know, women in the U.S., in Europe, could no longer do because of the shift, because of taking on wage work. But we have to be careful here. First of all, you know, as the globalization of care, the so-called globalization of care indicates, this cannot be a solution. You know, and certainly this restructuring of the global economy that has basically used the work of immigrant women, you know, as to respond to the reproduction crisis, to respond to the housework crisis, respond to the fact that by the 70s, many, many women were refusing, you know, their destiny as full-time housewives. That's certainly not a solution, considering the condition in which that is performed. Secondly, it's important to realize that the majority of women still perform a very large amount of housework in the home. And in fact, the condition of work outside the home have not qualitatively changed. Very few places of work, for example, have introduced childcare. Their hours of work, if anything, have increased. For those who still have a job, they have increased. Wages have gone down so much that in many cases you have to have two or three jobs in order to be able to support the family. And let's remember that increasingly the family is made of women who live alone with their children, who do not have a husband who supports them. So that in reality, you know, what has been happening, and this is now common sense, you know, is that women, the great majority of women, proletarian women, working class women, they have a work week that is similar to the work week of the Industrial Revolution. And it's not a surprise, for instance, that we have among women a very high level of consumption of antidepressant. And interesting enough, over the last 10 years, the life expectancy of women in the United States has decreased of 5 years. which means that a working class woman today in the U.S. Can expect to live 5 years less than her mother. And the reason clearly has to do with the fact that most women live in a situation of very much constant crisis. In fact, we can say that we are witnessing a very deep crisis of reproduction at all levels that is especially intense, appears especially intense when we see at women, at children, at people are not self-sufficient. Many elderly persons, for example, are not self-sufficient, you know, are suffering of this crisis because the resources that are made available to our reproduction are being continuously cut. You know? And wages, as we know, have also been increasingly decimated. And the kinds of rights that we expected were as an entitlement after many, many years of struggle, you know, are also vanishing. And women are really at the center of this crisis.
Sylvia.
For example, the fact we have seen a kind of a double move. On one side, women going outside the home to take jobs, and at the same time, at the very same time, you know, the government cutting, for example, all the kinds of services that in the past catered to some of the reproductive activity they were engaged. For example, for the last few years, every budget has cut resources to wealth, to child care for the elderly, and of course, transport costs have increased, which means less mobility. So, again, thinking of the feminist movement in a perspective, I think these are the great themes that the feminist movement today has to confront.
Sylvia,
today has to confront a government, a society, a social system, you know, that is persistently and today more than ever, basically depriving us of the most basic means of our reproduction.
Sylvia, I'm sorry. I have to interrupt here for a second. Can you hold that thought?
Sure.
I just need to say that this is KZYX. It's Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host, Cal Winslow. Our program today is an Antinomian Hour, and our guest is the feminist writer and activist Sylvia Federici. I just wanted to say here for our listeners who've asked about this that I think that antinomian is actually a very interesting term that you might want to check out, and I'll just say that I'm not using it in its religious sense, but in the sense that it's about people who, I said earlier, people like Sylvia, I think, who work against the grain and are not afraid to challenge society's orthodoxies and rules in that sense. So, Sylvia, I want to come back to those points that you were making, but tell us a little bit, if you don't mind, about yourself. How did you come to be to this country? How did you happen to come here as a youngster? And how have you managed to maintain the international perspective in your work and activity, which is really quite, interesting. Could you just say a word about that?
Sure. I came to write. I received a scholarship to come to write my dissertation here and in 1967. And then I began to postpone my return. These were also very interesting times. In 67 was the peak of many movements. And in the early 70s, I became involved in the feminist movement. And I had a brief marriage. And I eventually decided to stay. And so, of course, I came at a time in which being here was a tremendous learning experience. And, you know, later on, I had also had the possibility of spending time in Nigeria, and where I also taught for a while a few some courses, and that was again another important educational moment, because it opened up my horizon to understand not only the legacy of colonialism, but also understand, because the time when I was there was a very crucial time. It was really the beginning of globalization and the beginning of structural adjustment. You know, it's so, and I could see by being in Nigeria in the early 80s that a new process of primitive accumulation, you know, was beginning. Primitive accumulation is a term that Marx used to indicate, you know, that process that, in his view, gave, you know, was at the gave impulse to capitalist development, and he identified it with the moment in which, you know, land, the peasantry in Europe was expropriated from his land and forced to take the road and become, you know, peasants, former peasants were forced to become wage worker. I think that something similar has happened in the 80s and 90s with the globalization process. They really began with a massive, massive assault, you know, against the conditions of living of people in Africa, Latin America, Asia, with the introduction of stiff austerity program that basically destroyed the local economies, and also a massive process of expropriation of land, incomes, which explain why millions of people have migrated over the last two, three decades. They have migrated because the international policies forged by, you know, organizations like the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the government that support these institutions, you know, have basically stripped them from the possibility of making a living in their country of origin. So seeing that, you know, has really had a very profound effect on me. Already coming to the state, and had given me a more international perspective on the world, but also that experience. And then, of course, my relationship with Europe, it's that is always a reference point. But today, more broadly, I don't think that today you can understand what is happening in any particular place unless you understand the world. You know, the famous slogan, that you have to be local and global at the same time, and in the local you have the global. It's so completely true that you cannot politically ignore an internationalist perspective.
Okay, thank you. And let's go back then to where I cut in. Maybe just to say another question, refer to another aspect of your own work, and that is that I think it fits right in, that you've been associated or were associated with of movements called the Wages for Housework movement. Maybe a word about that.
The Wages for Housework campaign was an international campaign. We had groups in many parts of the United States and also in many countries. It was an upshoot of the kind of analysis that I presented, you know, before. And, you know, feminists in the early phase of the women's movement, we were all discussing, you know, where does the discrimination against women, where does the oppression of women come from? And, you know, there were different theories. Our theory was that it was rooted. Gender-based discrimination is rooted, you know, in the particular place in the organization of work, you know, to which women have been destined, which is the fact that women have been destined to be unwaged worker and unwaged domestic worker. So for us, this kind of analysis was very, very important because it made us understand a lot of things, not only about women, but also about capitalism. You know, we saw that, first of all, that this work, domestic work, as I mentioned before, is extremely productive because it produces the worker. We also saw, you know, something about the wage system. You know, we saw that the wage system, that the wage is not only a certain amount of money that seems to pay for work, but that the wage is really a system that shapes social relation, that in a way also serves to create differences, hierarchies, because with the difference between waged and unwaged labor, you actually create a whole hierarchy of labor, and you create a system of dependencies that has been, you know, very useful for the capitalist class, you know, to maintain its power. First of all, to extract a great amount, you know, of unpaid labor from women and to make that exploitation completely invisible. And moreover, it has served to delegate to men, you know, the wage worker, the power over women through the wage. In other words, when we speak of marriage and the family, in a sense, we don't see that the relationship there, a really relationship of production, a relationship of dependence, and how the way the structure, the marital relation, in a way that it has served to give the man the power to command the labor of women. And that kind of delegation of power that capitalism has made to the man, you know, through the family system and so forth, has been extremely effective, you know, in naturalizing exploitation, making it invisible and perpetuating the system. Now, starting from this analysis, you know, we decided that the strategy, you know, the first most important step we could take, the most important strategy, would be, in fact, to demand that wage housework be paid. First of all, because we saw that the demand itself had a great revelatory power, that by saying, you know, this is work, to making the very simple fact that this is work, that this is work that's producing capital. This is not only a personal service that I do out of my will, but actually out of all this cooking, this washing, this consoling, this organizing the home, this raising of children, actually that this is a particular type of industry. It's like an extension of the assembly line, except that it produces the worker as a worker. And not only, because in fact women are not free to set the condition of reproduction. And if you look at women's wife of different type of workers, you will see how deeply, how thoroughly, the work of the husband has shaped the life of the woman. If you are the wife of a miner or the wife of a white-collar worker, your life are completely different. And the whole employing class has benefited from the work of these women, who in fact have nothing of their own. They have to depend on a man if they want to buy a pair of socks, you know, and their work is not even seen as work. And they have no pension, no retirement benefits. You know, even Social Security, they have to wait 9 years of marriage before they can have access to it, and only through the husband, because this work is not recognized as work. At the very same time, as I said, that every employer benefits from it. So for us, the campaign for wages for housing had this double role. First of all, to reveal the inequity, the injustice perpetrated at the expense of women, to reveal this immense terrain of exploitation, and also to begin to reclaim some of the wealth that women have produced. And we saw it was clear that so many women, for example, stayed in situation of abuse, you know, with men with violence against them because they had nothing. They had more mobility because they had no money that would enable them to go outside the home and to have a different life. And even in the women's movement, and this is why I was critical before of the feminist movement at a certain point, when the issue, for instance, of childcare was raised, it was also raised to liberate women's time so they could also take a job outside the home. You know, because as a house worker, you're not seen as entitled to time of your own, because the work itself is not seen as work. So this was the struggle that we made, and the campaign that we organized. And I think that even though we did not gain wages for housework, that campaign was extremely important, certainly as a consciousness-raising tool, because I think that today, unlike in the 1960s, fewer and fewer people would say that domestic work is non-work. And the idea that, in fact, domestic work is the production of the workforce, is the production of labor power, is a particular part of the capitalist organization of work, is becoming more and more common sense.
Okay. I wonder if we could shift again then a little bit and tell us a little bit about your book with the very intriguing title, Caliban and the Witch. That's from The Tempest, isn't it?
Yes, Caliban and the Witch, it's an historical book. It's a political book, first of all, but it's also a historical book. It's a book that looks at the history of the development of capitalism, but he looks at it from the point of view of women and from the point of view of reproduction. It's a book that came out of my activism in the feminist movement and came out in particular from my realization that whereas there were very important works, you know, describing the development of capitalism, particularly, and Marx, first of all, you know, particularly the development of the wage worker and the factory system, there was very little written that described what happened to the process, to the work that we call reproduction, and what happened to women, you know, in the development of capitalist society. You know, how was the position of women transformed? How was reproductive work transformed? So I began the work, and it took me to a long journey that brought me back to practically the Middle Ages. You know, I had to study the feudal society in order to understand, you know, why capitalism developed. And this was very interesting because I discovered that the feudal world was a world of many, many struggles. It was not a world of just, you know, kings and queens and knights, but it was a world of, you know, day-to-day struggles by the peasantry, you know, against feudal exploitation, and struggles that by the, you know, 15th century were taking the form of really peasant wars. And I came to the conclusion that actually capitalism was a sort of counter-revolution. It was basically a system that developed, that was put in place, you know, by the feudal classes, you know, the merchant, the church, the landlord, in order to, so they will be able to maintain their power. And I basically revisited, you know, the processes that Marx, for instance, indicates as essential to the development of capitalist society. Central, first of all, for Marx, is the expropriation of the peasantry from the common lands, from the lands that they cultivated in common, which, again, as I mentioned before, forced thousands and thousands of people to take the road and become wage workers. But I saw that something else happened. And I saw, first of all, that there was another separation that was very important, that you can begin to see, to notice by the 16th century. And you begin to see that with development of monetary economy, production for the market, the circulation and production of commodity becoming more and more important, you begin to see a bifurcation in what we call the economy, whereas only certain type of work that is only production for the market is considered as work, whereas all the other activity, those that I would call reproductive activity, begin to disappear, you know, and they become the special, become feminized in the sense that more and more they become, quote, women's labor. So that was in a very, so I was able to trace, in fact, the period and the modalities in which, you know, this differentiation, this hierarchy of labor, and the new form of family that is built on it, you know, take shape. And that's one of the stories the book narrates. But central to the book is also the question of the witch hunts. You know, this for more than two centuries throughout Europe, thousands and thousands of women were arrested. They were tortured horribly and executed mostly by fire, accused of being witches. And this is a phenomenon that is incredibly important but has received very little historical attention. You know, only with the women's movement a new attention was given to the history of the witches. And this is really, in a sense, the central part of the book, because I saw that the witch hunt really a defining moment in the development of modern capitalist society. They're really a defining moment. They're not marginal at all, because they serve to destroy a whole world of social subjects and a whole world of practices that were incompatible with the new capitalist discipline of labor. And they also had a so-called constructive side, in the sense that through the witch hunt, you know, the witch hunt served to forge a new type of woman, you know, the new type of woman that was required, you know, by the capitalist organization of work, you know, the woman who basically will be ready to work for no remuneration, you know, the unpaid housewife. And they have to be silent, sacrificial, obedient, subordinate to man, who is defined as more feeble and of body and mind than men. And that the witch hunt was very much an attack on the power of women. I took the title Caliban from a play of Shakespeare, where Caliban is a play, the Tempest, that you know, describe an Italian prince shipwrecking in an island, and the first thing he does, he proceeds to enslave one of the local being that he finds there, which in the play he's described as a very monstrous being, almost animal-like, and much of the Tempest revolves around the struggle with this being who is Caliban, and everybody understands the Caliban. In fact, the name is an alliteration for cannibal. You know, that in the Tempest, there is a kind of prefiguration of the colonial system that was, in fact, developing at the time when Shakespeare was writing the Tempest, which was 1612. It was finished in 1612. And so the whole play between the prince and the monstrous being, it's really an enactment of what was happening in the plantation. So I took Caliban, you know, as a title, Caliban and the Witch. And in the play, it is said that Caliban is the son of the witch. So I took this title because it represented, you know, very well, you know, the theme of the book, that the theme of the development of capitalism, you know, was not only the development of a wage worker and the development of a wage proletariat, it was also the development of an unwaged population of workers. That being unwaged, you know, had to be, their unwaged condition, their exploitation, you know, had to be described as something natural, as something pertaining to their personality, you know. So the rise of sexism, the rise of racism, you know, it's very much connected to this destiny that, you know, the African, the enslaved African or the domesticated women of Europe through the witch hunt, or the domesticated women of the so-called New World, were destined to. And unfortunately, when I was writing Caliban and the Witch, I never imagined that in my own time I would have seen a return of witch hunting. But unfortunately, this is what has happened in recent years in many parts of the world, beginning with Africa, where, again, many women in recent decades have been killed, accused of witchcraft, of practicing witchcraft. And once again, I believe that this persecution is connected with the new processes, you know, with the new kind of relationship that have been set into place in many parts of the world because of the extension of capitalist relation.
This is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host for today's program, Cal Winslow. And our guest today is the writer, feminist activist, Sylvia Federici. We've just been talking about her book, Caliban and the Witch. A couple of other points that I'd like to ask you about. I think I've seen you write and speak about what you call a new round of enclosures, and also connected to that, I think you've written about feminism and the commons. I wondered if you could bring us to an understanding of what you think is important about enclosures and what you mean by the commons.
Right. You know, enclosure is a very technical term. It's a term that goes back to the 16th century. It's a term that was technically meant. It was the process where the landlord in the 16th, 17th century, and even later in England, put fences around the common lands, you know, because throughout feudal society, as in many parts of the world, you know, the agriculture was organized communally. But in Caliban and the Witch, I've pointed out that actually the process of enclosure was much wider in the past as it is in the present, much wider because not only the land was enclosed, but much more was enclosed. Knowledge was enclosed with the advent of capitalism. For example, all kinds of popular knowledges and productions of knowledges were in fact terminated or criminalized, and knowledge becomes the property of an expert class. You know, you begin to have the development of the profession, and I consider that an enclosure of knowledge. You know, had knowledge is becoming knowledge production increasingly privatized. The body of women was enclosed because with the rise of capitalism, and this is one point that I make in Caliban and the Witch, and it's in part of the motivation behind the witch hunt. The state begins to appropriate the body of women and, you know, in a sense, turn the body of women into machine for producing labor power, which means that, you know, all the forms of control the women had over procreation are now attacked. You know, with the witch hunt, they were attacked as demonic, and any forms of contraception. And basically, a whole system of surveillance was put into place to ensure, you know, the women could not actually control, you know, their productive capacity. And I call that a certain enclosure, a process of enclosure. And those, as I suggested before, in a different way, we have seen a return of these practices, of these developments, you know, throughout the 80s and 90s into the present. They are continuing today, you know, because, you know, globalization has represented a leap in the process of, you know, expropriation of people across the world of the basic means of their reproduction. You know, globalization has brought about a tremendous new wave of enclosures at all the levels they have described, enclosure of lands, enclosures of knowledge, enclosure of bodies. And in this context, it's not a surprise that the idea of the commons has come back, you know, in radical discourses across the world. And you know, today, both feminists, Marxists, ecologists, green movements are all, you know, interested in this question of the commons. And the commons represents many things today. First of all, it represents both the idea of creating a society in which we share the wealth, beginning with the present, starting from the present. So it refers to wealth to be shared, resources to be shared. Second, it refers to relationships of cooperation, a relationship of solidarity. And this idea, you know, comes in response to this extreme privatization that we are witnessing, that is affecting every form of life, and the fact that so many people, you know, cannot rely neither on the market nor on the state to reproduce themselves. So the commons signifies, first of all, today in radical political language, first of all, it signifies a means of survival. It signifies the idea that we need to pool our resources, you know, because increasingly we are in front of a system that does not reproduce us. But it also signifies something more. It signifies, you know, the will, the need to regain control of our life, to regain control of the most important decisions that affect our life, which now we do not have. To take an example, we don't know today when we feed ourselves whether we are ingesting poison or we are, in fact, eating something that is going to nourish us. But, of course, this can be extended to many other issues. So the important, we are regaining, you know, in front of a capitalism that is more and more brutal, more and more warlike, and more incapable of providing even the most basic means of our reproduction. The idea that we need to organize ourselves and so that we can create forms of self-government, you know, it's extremely important. And in this sense, the commons are not just the means of survival, but they are the for many people, you know, provide a kind of a base from which to be able to resist more from the type of assault that is happening every day on our life, and also a base from which to start reclaiming, you know, the wealth that people are producing and have produced, and that, you know, today is out of our reach. For me, in particular, as a feminist, the commons also has another significance, which is the fact that as feminists, I think we need to begin to rethink the way reproduction is organized. Because in capitalism, production is being organized in a way that separates us, isolates us completely. You know, we reproduce ourselves all isolated in our separate homes. And women have paid a high price for that. So I think there's been in the United States in particular, in the past, you know, in the 1890s up to the 1920s and 30s, Dolores Hides in the Grand Domestic Revolution has, you know, documented, you know, that whole period, that whole thinking, feminist thinking about how to create more cooperative way of domestic work and reproductive work. Well, for me today, the commons has the meaning too. I'm very interested in ways in which we can organize our day-to-day reproduction in a way that brings us together, in a way that is more cooperative and less isolating.
And a final thing, we have a few minutes left. You just mentioned that the systems seem to be becoming more warlike, and This has kind of been a summer of war, of many wars.
Yes.
And I wonder if you could say something as a feminist, or why feminists should be concerned about war, should oppose war.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Actually, women and feminists have had a long tradition of opposing war. And I hope that, in fact, that this tradition is continued today, or it is received a new impulse, because, you know, for instance, in the 1980s, you know, during the Reagan administration, there was a relaunching of the prospect of nuclear war and deployment of perishing missiles, you know, all over Europe. And many, you know, feminists created several anti-war camps: Greenham Common, Seneca here in upstate New York. Women, feminists and women in general, you know, have seen more directly, you know, the devastation the war produces in our life. And I think it's extremely important that we refuse it. And one way to refuse it is also to refuse to serve in the armies. I was very pained when I saw that many of my feminist sisters supported, or at least women who call themselves feminists, you know, supported the enrollment of women in the army. And now we see, in fact, that many of those women have actually suffered, you know, themselves an incredible amount of assault in the army in which they've served. You know, the cases of women who have been raped and even killed in the army have been more and more evident. So I think that it is important that we fight against all the armies and the wars, and in particular the wars that our own country is now promoting across the world. And those wars never only kill people away from us. They always have an effect on us. And we're witnessing, to say, a militarization of everyday life that is extremely scary. You know, not only continuously we have young people being killed by the police, but all our life is being militarized. We are continuously made to fear each other. You know, there is now an ideology that continuously incites us to see each other as dangerous instead of inciting our cooperation. And so I encourage my feminist sister across the U.S. and beyond to place the question of war as very central. And with that, also the question of prisons and the death penalty. We need a feminist movement to fight against the death penalty. This is an obscenity. The death penalty is a total obscenity. When we struggle to care for our children, you know, they have no resources for us. And then when the same children many times, you know, might break the law because they do not see other ways of surviving, then they're thrown into prisons. And this is something the feminists have to place on the agenda in a very central way.
Yes, I first met you, Sylvia, when you came to a class of mine to speak about the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Do you remember that? And maybe just in the 1 minute left to go, we've just had a ruling here in California that the legal ruling that the death penalty violates the Eighth Amendment. Is that an encouraging sign for you?
Well, it's an important step, but it's only a small step. I think you know, there was in 1972 there was a moratorium at the peak of the civil rights movement.
Hmm.
The civil rights movement, in fact, you know, resulted, one of the of its victories was the and the Black Power movement was to, in fact, put a moratorium de facto and then legally on the death penalty. The death penalty is reintroduced with the process of globalization in the late 1976. At that time, of the moratorium, it was justified on the basis that it was justified on the fact that it was arbitrarily organized, that it was administered in a way that it was based on unjust manner and discriminatory. But that's not enough. That's not enough. We have to say the state does not have the right to kill people.
Okay,
the
Sylvia.
State does not have the right to kill people.
Sylvia, on that note, which is very important, I have to say that we've run out of time, but I want to thank you very much, Sylvia Federici, the author of Caliban and the Witch and many other writings. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you this afternoon, so thank you. And I want to thank the listeners for tuning in and tell the listeners that this is Cal Winslow. Our program is an antinomian hour, and that we'll be back here next week at this same time. So good afternoon.